Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Look Ahead podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. And joining me today, as he does every Monday, is my good friend Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners for a look at the week ahead and to discuss whatever else is on his mind. Byron, welcome back and hope you guys had a terrific weekend.
We had a terrific weekend, Vago. As you know, I was at the Society for Military History, their annual meeting, but we can talk about that at a later time.
We are going to talk a little bit about that, and I am sorry I wasn't there and that we didn't have a chance to connect, but I'm going to ask you about that a little bit later in the program. But before we get started, a word from our sponsor. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and the only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII delivering the advantage. Byron, so much to discuss in the notes you had over the course of the week. Last week, you joined us with Dov Zakheim in the wake of the, stunning Iranian attack on Israel. And since then, we've had, obviously, Israel's response. We'll get to that in a minute. Obviously, the big news and the good news is that the House finally passed the $95 billion supplemental request, 8 months late, but better late than never. The $95 billion, roughly about 61 of that is for Ukraine. 26, if I'm not mistaken, billion is for Israel and for Gaza. And then the remaining 8 billion or so, everybody says it's for Taiwan. Only about 2 billion is for Taiwan. The rest of it is submarine industrial base, right? All the capabilities we need to better stand up to China and the Indo-Pacific. Sash Tusa of agency partners in London, who's part of the Washington the Business Roundtable team, basically concluded that even with this large amount of money, it's still not enough. He calculates it's about $100 billion a year that will be required for Ukraine to be able to win as opposed to just holding pace, that missiles are getting through because we're husbanding, or the Ukrainians are. And even with production increasing in the United States, for example, we'll be making a little north of 500 Patriot missiles a year, which won't be enough just to satisfy Ukraine's needs, much less refill our magazines. I understand everybody looks at this as a triumph, and clearly without this money, Ukraine would be in trouble. Do we need, as we discussed on yesterday's show, bringing in arsenals, multiple more production lines? Because however you want to slice the math, it doesn't work out for us to fill our magazines as well as support our allies and partners. How do we need to be doing this, and how do we need to be thinking about this problem?
Well, I think the first thing to start, Vago, is, it's good that the bills were passed. And frankly, I had underestimated Speaker Johnson's ability to, or willingness really, to shepherd these through. There was always the bipartisan support for, I think, all these pieces of legislation. It was just a simple matter of bringing it to the floor, which, in fact, Speaker Johnson finally did. So my hat's off to him. And as I think your listeners are all probably well aware by now, these were pretty strong bipartisan votes, with both Democrats and members of the GOP supporting the bills by pretty substantial margins. So to your point, I think there are a couple of things to point out. The money, the way, if you read the bill text, a lot of this money is going to be spread over fiscal year 24, 25, and frankly into 26. So it is money that's going to be spread over. It's not like this is going to be a flood of money that's going to hit the defense sector in May, June, and July. A portion of it will, but, and for the submarine industrial base, the way that language is written, that goes out to 2028 before those appropriations expire. So that's point number one. I think point number two is it really doesn't change the underlying supply network issues, labor workforce issues. I mean, just because Congress passed these bills doesn't fix the issues that have plagued production ramp rate increases on some of these major weapon systems. And I think it's going to be really interesting, having said that, to listen to what contractors say during earnings, which are going to start rolling in this week, particularly from the largest primes. Are they willing to step up production ahead of actual contract awards? Right. What are they doing now? I mean, if this isn't a clear enough signal and they're going to wait for contracts, you know, someone's got to say, hey, enough is enough. You know, you can make your personal assumptions about whether you think Ukraine is going to be in the war or not, and that's your business decision. But the idea that there's not a clear signal here from DOD is, you know, toss that one out the window right now.
We're going to get to, you know, what to expect from earnings in a moment. But one of the things over the years that we've discussed is, you know, producibility, right? That, you know, do we need to put designs on shelves sort of like we did with transport ships, for example, right? Break glass in case of emergency. This is what we can produce quickly. One of the points SASH has repeatedly made is we need more producible weapons that don't have to be to the nth degree. They need to be very good, but maybe not the be all end all, and certainly design them to be produced in greater volume. And I know that, you know, Bill LaPlante, Heidi Shu is, you know, they're both working with our allies and partners in order to be able to do some of these more harmonized designs. But unfortunately, they're not going to arrive too soon. What are some other options? I mean, are arsenals an option where you're holding some of this capability in government facilities, right? I mean, we've got a lot of GOCO plants in each of the military services, frankly.
What are the approaches that we should be using? Well, I want to go back. Let me answer your question. Then I want to go back because I didn't answer the first question. But the obvious thing you can do is just you can flush out U.S. inventories, you know, now, May, June, July, whatever we have on hand, we could flow over to support Ukraine and then hope that industry can step on the gas here and backfill some of those inventories in 2025 and beyond. I think the other part that is going to be important here is, you know, what else can be done with allies and their help? Although obviously this money is not going to be spent in Germany, Lithuania, Czech Republic, whatever. To Sasha's point, I would agree with him. I think what this will largely fund is weapons. You know, when you look at how the money, now there is flexibility in the way the language in the bills is written, but you know, how many M1s can you take out of storage? How long will it take to bring them up to snuff? What about engineering equipment? You know, I've seen reports that the Ukrainians really need more M113s because they've turned out to be a pretty good battlefield ambulance. So that's going to take time too. I'm not sure about kind of, you know, the wartime standard designs. They probably exist out there and they're probably a lot of good ideas. But, you know, I'm not sure if that's where the United States needs to go right now with this. That may be more, you know, for what Ukraine could do, you know, if they've got some headroom now from a financial aid standpoint, that there was money for kind of their, you know, functioning government. Does that give them a little bit more headroom to ramp up their own internal weapons production estimates, some of the shorter cycle stuff? That can make a lot of sense too.
So I guess, how do we get to that greater and higher degree of production if everybody is ultimately still balking at it, right? I mean, there are still questions about demand signal, even though we're seeing a pretty strong demand signal.
Well, I mean, I've written about this, and I still firmly believe, you know, we can talk about what Secretary Del Toro has been talking about with share repurchases and the defense sector. It's like, hey, if you don't like it, find other companies that you think are using money that they've made on defense contracts to meet your ends and goals. And so this is where some of the defense startups come in, non-traditionals, large and small. I mean, you know, right. It doesn't all have to go to RTX, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, you know, the biggest defense contractors. There are people out there who probably have good ideas, and maybe that's a good way to accelerate this. And you've already seen this. I mean, in the propulsion area, you know, I've always found it interesting. Some of these market segments that people thought were kind of technology backwaters have actually been where some of those dynamic change has been happening.
Right. Yeah, indeed. A whole bunch of terrific notes. And I want to go to the defense offense trade-off question in the wake of both the extraordinary defense against Iran's extraordinary attack on Israel, where Israel, as well as U.S., British, French, Jordanian, other nations sort of pitched in to try to shoot down as much of this capability. The U.S. took care of some of this over Iraq. Some of it was handled over Jordan, right? I mean, there were a lot of hands that made short work of this, more than 330 things that were shot, whether ballistic cruise missiles or attack drones. And then that fueled, right, a big debate about, well, you know, does it make sense to use AMRAAMs to shoot down Shaheds and things like that, which might be a wrong way of looking at it. The question is how much damage the Shahed would do if it did hit its target. As we're seeing in Ukraine, right, it doesn't take a lot, and you can actually take out the you know, plunge a million people or more into darkness or worse. How do we need to think about this? Because folks kind of devolve into some of these arguments that you've always said are somewhat specious. What's the right way? Well, you know, even though there is cost imposition strategy at work.
Absolutely. There is a cost imposition strategy, and it will, but it's not new. I mean, it's been going on for years now. I mean, it's been part of the debate over China and their investment in missile forces, you know, how much it costs to intercept those missiles. So I don't see it as, you know, it's just something that again gets highlighted in the context of this most recent conflict. I mean, to me, it's kind of like complaining about paying for insurance. It costs a lot, but you got to think what happens if you don't pay for insurance. You know, you can lose your home or your car, and that's going to cost far more in most instances than what your premium are is for your insurance policy. So, you know, and I wrote about it. It's like, okay, these two analysts had written this essay. I referenced it in my note. You know, it was actually a pretty interesting piece of work. I guess my kind of two pushbacks on it were, well, you can't really just compare, you know, missiles to missiles. You really have to think about the all-in systems. You know, it's not just the missile themselves, and they actually talked about flight hour for F-16 and F-35s, but okay, throw in the tankers. I mean, how far back do you want to reach into what it costs to field this full capability? But then on the other hand, so what's your answer? I mean, if you don't have that capability, and something cheaper isn't available. I mean, directed energy has been kind of seen as the holy grail to solve this problem, but it's still not ready, I suppose, to be fielded in the volume and with the coverage that might allow a defeat of an attack like this. And it might be fine against drones. Ballistic missiles or hypersonic weapons may be an entirely different problem. And directed energy has some of its own issues, like, you know, what happens if you aim for a missile, you know, hit it, but then the laser stays on and you end up hitting a satellite in low Earth orbit and disable that. So there's some peculiarities to this that hopefully it could be a breakthrough, but it's not available today. So unfortunately, you're still going to have to pay these prices for interceptors, missiles, things that cost a lot more than the things they shoot down. But hopefully, and ideally, that's protecting lives and it's protecting assets that have far greater prices to repair. Either, you know, the case in point, a power plant in Ukraine, or if the Israelis didn't have this capability, they'd lose, you know, what, an F-35 squadron or two in an airbase in the Negev? How much does that cost to replace?
Exactly right. I mean, it's sort of the cost of the B-2 and the bomb. It drops relative to, well, it's only a cheap bridge. Well, I mean, if it's strategically or tactically important in the waging of a conflict, it's a price well worth paying in order to try to do that, right? So I always find these things are almost always false, false calculations, especially since we don't have the magic system yet. We don't have the directed energy system that'll work. And to your point, right, it's almost like the bomber formation defense, right? Everybody is shooting, but you know, unfortunately, some of our own aircraft were shot down as everybody was trying to defend themselves, because, you know, all you have to do is rake the airplane next to you and you're in trouble, just like that directed energy system can take out or damage a satellite in orbit that you might need. Let me take you to the question of Iran, right? You have written that if they weren't going to go nuclear, they're more likely than not to go nuclear now. My suspicion and fear is that they've already on the cusp of doing that, and that this attack was just the test, right? I mean, if you only have a handful of weapons, you might want to explore how you can smuggle those nuclear wolves in along with a vaster herd of sheep. How does this change the calculation, Byron, right? Because we talk a lot about Iran going nuclear. Okay, at this point, Iran has struck Israeli soil proper. Israel now has struck Iranian soil. As you've pointed out, deterrence failed. What does the next step of this look like?
Well, hopefully deterrence, we kind of reached a standoff period. I think both sides demonstrated a capability that the other side knew. I mean, if the Iranians hadn't figured out that Israel could reach well into Iran, you know, they've got cement between their ears. And if the Israelis didn't realize that Iran was capable of large missile barrage against them, they've got cement between their ears. So, and I would agree, you know, but I think as much as there's kind of a collective sigh of relief that, you know, here we are a week later and this hasn't exploded into a broader Middle East context, a conflict, that's good, but the underlying problems haven't been solved. And who's to say what the next red line is that either side could cross, and the other side says, deterrence has failed. We've got to take a stab at this again. So I'm riffing a little bit on how markets react off of this. They are, you know, quite concerned, gyrations in oil, gold, safe havens, all, you know, run to the hills, and then the strike doesn't happen. Oh, it's all fine. The all clear signals. We can go back and, you know, do it. But the underlying, you know, the underlying dynamic that causes these threats and events hasn't changed. So so I suppose that's the next question in my mind is, well, what will happen to try and prevent this from the next time? And I suppose, you know, that's got to come from diplomacy and discussion, and I just don't see any of that, any sign of that on Monday today.
Well, I mean, as that war has receded, now the U.S. focuses back on Gaza, where there was a very tragic strike in Rafah that happened that involved children that were killed. So that's going to just reinvigorate that debate again. Let me briefly ask you a multi-body nuclear deterrence question, right? I mean, at the end of the day, there are still rules even in nuclear fight club. And with at least an X number of responsible nuclear powers, we haven't had the kind of nuclear exchanges that everybody has sort of worried about. If Iran goes nuclear, I mean, I understand there's a problem that, you know, they are, or at least some in the regime are messianic kooks. Does this work in a way that once they go nuclear, then it's sort of out and on the table? Hey, Israel's nuclear, you're nuclear. Okay, now what?
Yeah, well, and now what, sir? Okay, then what keeps the Saudis from going nuclear? What keeps the Emiratis from going nuclear? What keeps the Turks from going nuclear? I mean, it's a daisy chain. And I just think, you know, I mean, as much as people think, yeah, maybe there's some messianic crazies who would lob weapons on Israel just to satisfy some vision, you know, we kind of, when you were bracing that, Vago, I kept thinking, well, doesn't Kim Jong-un have like 50 or 60 nuclear weapons, you know, and I wouldn't consider him, a level-headed citizen of the world. So, yeah. There are other, and I'm actually reading this book on nuclear war, A Scenario, which is kind of a page-turner, but the woman who wrote it, you know, the premise is there's a bolt from the blue strike by North Korea on the United States. Her kind of minute by minute, second by second walkthrough about what actually happens in that scenario. It's a very potent reminder. I think, you know, it can lead us to another discussion about nuclear weapons in general. You know, the fact that New START treaty will expire in 2026. You know, so maybe there is going to be some broader discussion about, you know, yeah, you think these weapons buy you a lot of safety and protection, and maybe project a regime, but the consequences of their use. I think it's good to read something like this as a reminder about what they're really all about.
Nobody has ever accused Kim Jong-un of being stable. Then again, neither was his dad nor his grandfather, even though we heard from Patrick, right, that he's supplanting his grandfather has tried to dampen that. Let me take you to the question of shipbuilding, right? Another thoughtful note where you were sort of riffing off of what Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro mentioned at Navy League, right? I mean, he's spoken very highly of some of the overseas shipbuilders he's visited. He was talking about Korean shipbuilders and what a terrific job they do. This is not a new thing, where even the most cutting-edge American shipbuilders have gone abroad for lessons on how to build military ships better. But this also sort of oddly would seem to divorce. There's a difference between Royal Caribbean ordering a ship that's delivered in a year and a half to specifications and what the U.S. Navy does. The U.S. Navy bought an off-the-shelf ship, the Fremm design, that's in service in the Italian and French navies, and then comprehensively changed the ship, right? I mean, so how do we need to think about this shipbuilding space when everybody sort of just looks at these lessons and listens to the rhetoric as opposed to what the reality is? You know, I mean, any of these companies can build ships faster. HII, our sponsor on this program, could build ships a heck of a lot faster. It's just they're built to a specification and the Navy is an involved customer.
And the specifications, you know, the U.S. shipbuilding industry still builds some of the largest, most complex surface and subsea vessels in the world.
And highest quality, I mean, to be blunt.
And highest quality. And not to, you know, take a knock at the French or the British. They're, I think, in that league too. And frankly, the Japanese and the Koreans. But I think what's interesting is, you know, to compare like the volume, the layout of yards in Korea and Japan, and then by default, you know, China. I mean, I'll just say this, Vago. It's been intriguing to me for a long time about, you know, the fact that U.S. has been able to field a Navy without a big commercial shipbuilding industry. And that's really a divorce from history, if you think about it. And I think what that means and what the concern that I'd have is, you know, in a protracted conflict that doesn't go nuclear with China, who do you think is going to win the shipbuilding race? You know, how easy is it going to be for China to convert its yards, its maritime capacity to build surface combatants? And you're kind of looking at, you know, the United States in 1939 or 1940, you know, you could draw that analogy with China. And maybe the United States looks more like Japan. I mean, you could build at a higher rate, but you don't have that capacity to flex. So having said that, you know, there's an event this week by Washington International Trade Association that talks about kind of the next trade dispute with China is going to be its subsidies for commercial shipbuilding. And there's been a movement, you know, I think Representative Neal from Massachusetts has talked about this. You know, why can't we build a U.S. domestic commercial shipbuilding industry again? You know, when I hear that, it's like, oh boy, you know, we're having enough trouble, you know, hiring 100,000 people for the submarine industrial base over the next 10 years. And you want to start building commercial ships as well? Like, how are they possibly going to be competitive without massive subsidies from the United States? The labor rates alone are going to kill you. So right, maybe it's a price to pay, but at least have that discussion in the open. And let's not pretend that this is something that, you know, pass a bill, snap your fingers, and there are going to be all these people showing up on day two in Philadelphia or somewhere in the West Coast or the Gulf Coast to go build commercial ships. It's not going to happen.
Well, I mean, and one of the things we should bear in mind is, you know, there is subsidization that happens. I mean, you know, none of these, you know, they're accepting margins other people wouldn't accept. There's all sorts of investment that goes into it where they create the, you know, degrees of automation and what have you And it's unclear whether or not we're going to make that investment, especially with our labor rates and our national tax policies. Let me we're going to go into a little bit of lightning round because we've got about 5 minutes left in the program. You put a cybersecurity maturity model certification or CMMC note out, which I thought was interesting, right? Obviously, that's an initiative to deputize companies have self-reporting to improve, you know, defense industrial-based cybersecurity. Give us your thoughts.
Well, it wasn't. It was just part of my. It was really kind of thinking about some of the events this coming week, and actually one of them, the Baroni Center at George Mason University, which has done some terrific work on defense acquisition under Jerry McGinn, they're having an event on CMMC 2.0, and you know, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here. I don't think anybody disagrees with the fact you've got to have cyber security and standards that prevent the loss of, in this case, it's controlled unclassified information. But it's just going to be an interesting issue because the DoD released the rule for comment on December 26. The comment period closed February 26. In the NDIA report on the defense industrial base, they actually referenced this, that, hey, there's going to be a cost to have contractors see third-party certification, so-called level two certifications. That's really a couple of billion dollars, and that's the DOD's estimates. That's not a third-party estimate, part of the rule. So the question that, and this is, again, kind of in a lead into earnings season, you know, how are contractors thinking about that? I think, like, you know, is this a question of kind of out of the frying pan into the fire? We've just gotten through the, you know, pandemic recovery and, you know, all the disruption occurred there. Well, then if this rule, presuming this rule is going to get finalized and rolled out in the first quarter of 2025, you know, is it going to force more small companies out of the defense business? Are there going to be mechanisms for those small contractors to pay for this? You know, is this something, maybe this is something Secretary Del Toro should be leaning on, like, hey, instead of buying back stock, can you help your small contractors become compliant with CMMC 2.0? So, you know, $100,000, $200,000 certification costs is nothing, but for a 20-person machine shop in Tennessee, it might be a big deal. So, and if it's a make or break for are they in the business or not, I think you want to keep them in the defense sector or working in the defense sector.
Absolutely. Real quick, earnings, your broader expectations, and then give us a look at the week ahead and what folks should be tuning into, even if you've interspersed this throughout the whole conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, it's going to be a pretty good, I don't have any reason to expect, you know, blowups, disappointments. The outlay numbers, Fago, that came out suggested, you know, once again, investment outlays were up, I don't know, upper single digits when you blend in O&M and investment. So, you know, organic sales growth should be fine. Operating margins, you know, still a question of the supply network issue, the problems working through. But again, I think, you know, industry seems to have their arms around this problem. I suppose a bigger question is just, you know, are they going to change their long-term expectations because of the supplemental package that just passed? And again, you know, I think a focus, at least the analysts who get on these calls and then the investors who follow up after the calls, okay, you know, all this money kind of goes to where we started this conversation off. What can you do to accelerate this? You know, what are you going to wait for contracts? Are you going to step up hiring? You know, what are you doing with your supply networks to meet this demand signal?
And what should the audience be paying attention to this week? Because it is a massive list of events.
Yeah, but I think unusually so. You know, besides earnings, it's just this time of year. CSIS is holding a national security forum. I think General Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is going to be speaking along with Avril Haines, the DNI. Admiral Franchetti, the chief of naval operations, is also going to be speaking the day before at CSIS, and Secretary Del Toro that same day at Stimson Center. I mentioned the Baroni Center event on CMMC 2.0. AUVSI's Exponential 2024 is taking place in San Diego. There's a defense component of that. There are a bunch of geopolitical events or events that the think tanks are holding on various aspects of geopolitics at Chatham House, Atlantic Council, and again at CSIS. So, and then of course, earnings season and the deluge of reports from contractors. So, it'll be a pretty informative week in terms of incremental perspective on how the DoD is thinking now that this supplemental package has passed.
And 30 seconds on the Society of Military History, seeing as how you are a longstanding and august member of the body.
There are always really interesting takeaways from something like this. You know, my trick is to take those little historical vignettes and then think, okay, what does this mean for the defense sector in 2024 through 2030? And, you know, it's just fascinating some of the detail that people can go into. You know, one of the things I was at this morning was just kind of modifications, kind of the old Yankee ingenuity that were made to armored vehicles during World War II. And, you know, whether that, I suppose, has changed, you know, someone pointed out to me, another person was complaining about the fact that his kids don't know how to repair a car these days. You know, this guy and my son have also done the same thing. Well, they build their own computers on the other hand. So it's a different skill set. We ought to just move on from bemoaning, you know, well, they can't fix the car, but they can write code and build computers.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, at some point they're worrying less on the buggy whip. And pretty soon when they're electric cars, we won't be doing anything with them anyway. And I'm sorry for misspeaking. It was the Society for Military History, not of, because I don't know what I was thinking. Byron, thanks very much. It's always a pleasure. Great having you on. Have a great week and look forward to having you back on next week.
Very good, Vago. Thank you.
And I should point out to our audience that David Norquist, former Deputy Defense Secretary, who is now the CEO and President of the National Defense Industrial Association, will be joining us on tomorrow's program to discuss vital signs as well, which is NDIA's latest report that Byron referenced in our conversation. And he discussed a couple of weeks ago on the show, and we're going to talk to him about much more than that. Before we go, a quick word from all of our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Thanks very much for joining us today. We appreciate it very much, and we hope that you'll join us again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.